Welcome to Catalytic Leadership, the podcast designed to help leaders intentionally grow and thrive. Here is your host, author, and leadership and executive coach, Dr. William Attaway.
Hey, it's William, and welcome to today's episode of the Catalytic Leadership Podcast. Each week, we tackle a topic related to the field of leadership. My goal is to ensure that you have actionable steps you can take from each episode to grow in your own leadership. Growth doesn't just happen. My goal is to help you become intentional about it. Each week, we spotlight leaders from a variety of fields, organizations, and locations. And my goal is for you to see that leaders can be catalytic no matter where they are or what they lead. I draw inspiration from the stories and journeys of these leaders, and I hear from many of you that you do too. Let's jump into today's interview. I'm so excited today to have Marcel Petipas on the show. Marcel is the CEO and co-founder of Periquito, a company that is dedicated to helping agencies measure and improve their profitability by streamlining their operations and reporting systems. He's also the head strategic coach at SaaS Academy by Dan Martell, the number one coaching program for B2B SaaS businesses in the world. In his work as a speaker, podcast host, and consultant, specializing in agency profitability optimization, he has helped hundreds of agencies around the world measure the right metrics and improve their operations and profitability without relying on financial data and accounting professionals, and take control of their business with simple numbers anyone can understand and measure. When he's not helping agencies make more money, he's probably watching The Office or Parks and Rec on a never-ending loop and eating breakfast foods for every meal of the day. Marcel, I'm so glad you are here. I've been looking forward to this conversation.
Likewise, William, I appreciate you having me.
I would love to start by you sharing a little bit of your story with our listeners, particularly around your journey and your development as a leader. How did you get started?
My career kind of started at Apple as an account manager, and I had a great manager working in that job, and I learned a lot from him. His name was Steve Capagreco, and I learned a lot about how to find that sweet spot of giving somebody autonomy and also letting them make their own mistakes and learn some things the hard way. And, you know, how to know when to step in. He was really quite good at that balancing act as a manager. And from there, I decided to move on and start my own agency, which was my first business. And that's where I became familiar with the challenges that we solve today for agency owners, trying to answer simple questions every day about, you know, are we making money on clients and projects? When can we take on our next project? Who do we need to hire and when? And, you know, that balancing act of work coming in and needing more resources and people to get that work done, and just finding it extremely difficult, not only to figure out how to measure these things, but to actually do it in practice and get all the data together to do it. And then I became interested in software as a service. That's where, you know, I met Dan Martell and started working more closely with him. And a few years later, a good friend, a mutual friend of ours, got put in contact with me, and he just shared, like, hey, he ran a much bigger agency than I'd ever run. So, you know, I spend 2 days a week in spreadsheets trying to answer these questions. There has to be a better way to do this. Every agency owner that I talk to that's a peer has the same problem. And I resonated with that immediately and said, okay, well, let's work on solving this problem. That was almost 6 years ago today. We've been through lots of twists and turns, but, you know, thankfully figured out a way to get this solved and have been able to build a company since then.
You know, you bring so much credibility to this because you ran an agency, right? And you saw firsthand the pitfalls, the tripwires that trips so many people up. I love one of the things you just said, but one of the things that's jumped out at me, this idea of, you know, are we making money on this client or on this service? You would think that's a really simple question to answer, right? And yet, so many of the agency owners that I work with, when you pose that simple of a question, their answer is, I think so. Do you see that?
Absolutely. And I think that this is one of the things that not enough people are acknowledging about professional services in general is, you know, the advantage to professional services is there's very little capital cost to get started. There's very little barrier to entry. If you have a skill, you can go out and you can start working for yourself. If you have a you know, group of people around you, a network that has skill, you can start to scale that up into a business. So it's great. It's easy to start, but it's difficult to scale because we don't have fixed costs. It's not like selling a widget or selling a piece of software or selling a product. The amount of time that it takes to get something done for a client determines what it costs you. And one of the traps that I think a lot of people fall into when they first start is they're not valuing their own time as the founder. They're spending a lot of their time subsidizing projects. And it's not until they're forced to build a team underneath them, become the leader of that team, and incur the direct cost of spending more or less time than expected on things that they now have to, you know, essentially address this issue that they've been able to defer for a while by subsidizing those challenges with their evenings and weekends.
So how do you suggest agencies measure their performance? I mean, you talk a lot about this in so many different venues. Like, what are the things that people should be looking at as agency owners? What are the key elements?
So we'll start with intake, which is, you know, when you're pricing or scoping a project and how to set yourself up for success from that point. Because I say this all the time, most agencies are suffering from indigestion, not starvation. They just happen to feel the same. And what I mean by that is, you know, I'll often talk to agency owners that are doing $10 million a year in revenue, and they're not making money, or they have razor thin profit margins. And so clearly, none of those businesses are suffering from starvation. They have millions of dollars of revenue coming in the door. Something is going on between when that money is collected and when the deliverable is given to the client and, you know, all the invoices are paid for the business, that's causing there to be less money left over than there should be based on how this business was designed to operate. And that's what we really need to get focused on. And what we find in auditing agencies is the majority of them have what we call a delivery margin problem. And for those of you that are familiar with, you know, some basic financials, delivery margin is probably the same thing that you would call gross margin or contribution margin. What we're really trying to figure out here is, what does it cost you to earn a dollar, right? So if a client gives you a dollar and you make a promise in return, how much money do you have to spend to fulfill that promise? And how much of that dollar is left over? And ultimately, as a business, we want to try to have at least 50% of every dollar that clients pay us left over after the promise has been delivered on. That way, we have 20 or 30% of that dollar to spend on overhead and growth. And then we hopefully have 20 to 30% left on the bottom line to actually reward ourselves and the other founders and executives in the team, and perhaps even our team if we want to do profit sharing, for the risk that we took investing in this business. And in order to do that, we need to target anywhere from 60 to 70% delivery margin when we sell a project to a client. And so that's really the starting point. And I find that agencies really, they trip themselves up when they price and scope projects in a bunch of ways. And we could dig more deeply into why and how that is. But most of the time, they're either not aware that they're underpricing, or they are aware of what their margins are, but they're just not targeting a high enough margin to really set their business up for success from the start. And so essentially, they're behind the eight ball from the moment they sell a project, because that indigestion is designed into how they've priced and scoped that work.
Is that underpricing something that you're seeing like in a lot of different places, a lot of different agencies?
Yeah. And when I say underpricing, there's two sides to that equation, right? I mean, you could underprice in the sense that you know it's going to take a lot of time and you just don't charge enough for that. So you're just not giving yourself enough margin. That's a conscious decision. And sometimes it is the right thing to do because we have to utilize our team. So if we have this option next month to either sell some work at a discounted price and have some work for our team to do, or have our team be sitting on their hands, or option three is we have to lay some people off. Yeah. Oftentimes, it may very well make sense to discount the work intentionally. But the other side of this, which I see very often, is we just underestimate the time it's going to take to get the work done. And so it costs us a lot more than we thought. And so that's, you know, often called over-servicing, but in some cases, it's the result of underpricing. And where I see this happen most often is when the way that work is priced has a coupling between time and budget. What I mean by this is, we arrive at a price for a client by saying, here's how many hours we have. Let's multiply that by some billable rate. Oftentimes, there's not really much thought put into that billable rate. It's not clear what the margin on that billable rate is expected to be. And then we arrive at a price. Or worse yet, we go to the client, we say, what's your budget? And then we divide that budget by the hourly rate we want to achieve. And then we say, okay, well, this is how many hours we have to complete this work, which to me is like such a dangerous trap to fall into, because there's no reconciliation of, is that even realistic, right? And so what often happens in that situation is the client says, hey, that amount of money that you're asking me for is too much. My budget is lower. Can you do it for that? And often what happens, because there's this intrinsic coupling in this agency's pricing model between time and money, is they'll go back and they'll lower the budget by lowering the amount of hours on the project, even if the scope hasn't actually changed. And so what they're doing in that case is they're not the client, nothing's changing for the client. They're going to pay the price that the agency comes back and asks them to do. But for the agency, what they've just done is they've just lied to themselves about how much time they think it's going to take to get this thing done. Wow. And then 6 months later, when they've built the website for the client and everyone's sitting down to do their project retrospective and they go, oh, wow, we really blew through the budget on this one. They're all kind of pissed off, because they forgot that, well, actually, we set ourselves up for failure from the start, and we knew it was going to take longer than this in the original estimate, but for some reason, we decided to obfuscate that, because the way that we think about pricing has this unbreakable link between time and money. And of course, those two things are not intrinsically linked to one another. They're related, but they're not the same.
You know, I think you're spot on there. And, you know, when they make that choice to obfuscate the actual time, the actual cost, you know, whether it's in minutes or dollars, and they know at the beginning, but they choose to kind of push that to the side. It reminds me of something that a friend of mine will often say, you know, bad news is not like a fine wine. It does not get better with age. We shove it to the side. We shove it under a rug. We think, oh, it'll take care of itself. It'll get better. It'll go away. That has not been my experience. Like, you need to deal with that directly. And as the business owner, it is your responsibility to lead from the front on this. But I see the same thing. People who are like, oh, you know, yeah, we'll get it. We'll take care of it. I'll take care of it. And they invest more of their own intention, more of their own time, their own effort than they ever wanted to. And one day they wake up and say, this business that I created, that I started from nothing to give me time, financial and location freedom, has given me none of those. It has become a cage.
Well, that's absolutely right. We see that all the time. And if we want to tie this back to leadership, I think one of the tragic impacts that this can have is it creates this false negative, which is that somehow the team has failed on this project.
Because they
went way over budget. And if we're doing this chronically, then we have this impression that this is a chronic issue. And the reality is, we didn't realistically estimate this from the start. We lied on the estimate to ourselves.
Yes.
We did that to ourselves. But again, if the team is constantly feeling like, hey, we're constantly failing, we're constantly having these negative project retrospectives about how we went over budget, there's this issue in the business, but that issue isn't really solvable, because we're not seeing truthful information about what was actually expected for this to take. The team feels like they're being set up for failure. The team feels like the budgets are unrealistic. That's a really negative place to be. And think about how difficult it is to create accountability and autonomy in that kind of a framework where it just feels like they're being set up for failure. So this is where I think really developing mastery around numbers is important as you start to build that team, because you need to be able to use that data to create accountability and create a shared understanding of what's happening in the business, so that you can actually allow your team to have more autonomy over achieving results. And until that is in place, it's very, very difficult to get to that level and to really start to install layers of management and build teams that can get things done without being micromanaged.
And if the team feels like that over time, they feel like they're losing, they feel like they're failing consistently, time over time. I mean, that's going to have a huge impact on retention of your team members. They're not going to stick around. Nobody wants to stick around in a losing environment.
That's right. And some of the byproducts of this are, you're going to see one of two things. Either there's just going to be frustration. They're constantly going to feel like they're failing. They're going to quit. Or they're going to start lying on their timesheets, or you know, they're going to start underlogging time, and then they're going to start to get overworked because they're so sick of having this negative project retrospective where it's like, hey, you blew through this budget, that it's like, hey, this thing takes 200 hours to do, but you keep quoting it at 125. So I'm just going to use my evenings and weekends and not log that time. And all of these things are toxic. All of these things are really problematic and lead to issues. And it's just basically this fundamental lack of clarity, this fundamental lack of honesty. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is often institutionalized in the framework that a business uses to measure their performance. So that's why I'm so passionate about this problem, because it's not actually about getting an owner of an agency an extra summer home or a yacht or, you know, a big fat retirement fund. When this stuff is done well, all of the stakeholders in an agency are well served by it.
Yes. I think the highest job of a leader is to raise up, to level up the people that they lead. You get to pour into them. You get to invest in them. If you're not being honest as the leader, you're exactly right. They're going to start not to be honest as the team members, right? With themselves and ultimately with the company. Is that the culture you want to create as the leader? I don't know. I don't know a great leader who would say, oh yeah, that's what I'm after. I mean, nobody wants to do that. And yet, more and more, that's exactly what I'm seeing. And it sounds like you're seeing the same thing.
I am. Now, I want to be clear that most of the time, this isn't intentional or nefarious.
Right? Nobody goes into it thinking, oh, this is what I'm going to build. Right?
That's right. Most of the time, the way that the framework for measuring an agency's performance is developed is by piecemeal. Yeah. And it comes together either by different managers or different people within the organization bringing ideas from the previous firm that they were at into the business and then trying to cobble them together, or doing research and picking metrics, you know, from one expert or one blog and trying to bring them together. And that's a really dangerous and often problematic way to build a reporting framework for the business, because there isn't consistency between those metrics. And so another thing that we see all the time is when we go into a business, they're investing tons of time and money measuring all kinds of great KPIs, often even the ones that we recommend they measure. But because they're not in a consistent framework, I've had this conversation with a CEO before where they go, you know, my ops manager is managing all of these metrics. They're hitting all their targets. My finance manager over here is managing these metrics. The sales team is managing these metrics. Everybody's hitting their targets. And yet there's 15% of my bottom line that I don't know where it is, but it's not in my bank account. And I can't figure out what's wrong. And, you know, we spend 5 minutes looking at that and we go, oh, well, you know, the way you're defining a billable hour in this area is different than how you're doing it in this area. And the way that capacity is being modeled by your ops manager is different than the way your finance manager is thinking about capacity. And the way you measure gross margin on a project after the fact is different than how you're estimating it. And these little differences add up to this 15% bottom line. So it's really important to be intentional and bring all this stuff together in a way that's consistent so that everybody across departments can be on the same page and you don't end up with these kind of gaps, these gaps where things slip through the cracks and again, kind of lead back to some of these issues where it feels like the expectations aren't clear and aligned across those different stakeholders. Mm.
And that is so good. I'm just processing what you're saying. And I'm hoping that everybody who is listening is capturing this, because there's gold here. Like, what you're sharing is something that every agency owner I've ever interacted with or worked with needs to understand. This is the path that will take you where you want to go. Cobbling together, pulling from this and that, and oh, I like that, I'll pull that in. Creating a Frankenstein approach, if you will. Like, this is not going to be helpful to you. It's not going to take you where you want to go. It's got to be something consistent. I love the way you talk about this.
Yeah. I think one of the issues is that oftentimes what I see in a firm is people are kind of voluntold to figure this stuff out. And they're doing this from each of their departments. So, you know, the sales team, it's like, hey, figure out how to measure the sales metrics and give me this information. And then the finance person, hey, you know, give me the right metrics. Often they're just kind of trusting the finance person to do that in the right way. And frankly, most of the time, they're not doing it, in my opinion, in the right way. And it's the same thing with the ops person, which is often the project manager that's been around the longest that gets, you know, upgraded to an ops manager overnight. And it's like, hey, you got to figure out how to make, you know, track the profitability of all our projects and do resource planning. And they're kind of left to their own devices to figure these things out, often in silos. And when I ask a firm, well, whose job is it to bring this stuff together? Either the answer is nobody, or somebody's been voluntold to do this. And frankly, it's not even within the scope of their job. And they're being set up for failure. And often they're exasperated and frustrated and quite defensive when we start the conversation, until I sit on their side of the table and say, you know what, it's really not fair that you're being asked to do this. And it's not a good use of your time either. So I'd love to talk, if it's relevant, about how to kind of ladder up from, okay, we figured out how to price projects and set ourselves up for delivery margin. How do we then kind of measure the performance of the business thereafter and take control of it and really bridge the gap between finance and operations, which I find is one of the most difficult things for people to do?
I agree. I think that is it feels like a Grand Canyon sized gap for a lot of business owners. How do you bridge that?
So our framework, and I want to make it clear that when I explain our framework, this is our framework. So the way to measure each of these individual metrics is not necessarily the correct way, but it's the way that we do it, because the way we measure each of the metrics in this framework makes it consistent with the rest of the framework. And at the end of the day, that's what's most important. So you could choose to do any of these things differently, but you just have to make sure you chase down the 15 different dependencies with the decision that you make about how to measure that one metric differently, because it has to be consistent with everything else. So with that in mind, the way that we would recommend doing this is, on the financials, we really need to measure and understand delivery margin. And most P&Ls, when we look at them, and we look at about a half a dozen P&Ls a month of different firms, almost none of them can actually see their delivery margin. So the way that we calculate this is really important. The first thing we need to do is we need to isolate what's called pass-through expenses. And so to give you an example of what pass-through expenses are, this would be things that flow through your business onto other vendors that you're not responsible for the profitability of. So easy examples here are advertising spend, print budgets, materials, maybe external vendors that do things that you don't do internally. Like if you are an ad agency, but you don't do any video production, and a client needs a video, you might bring, you know, another partner in to do that video. So all of that revenue is passing through you into external vendors. We need to strip that out of your revenue so we can get to what we call agency gross income, which is what is the amount of money that you're actually earning as an agency and that you need to now earn with your time, after we strip out all that other stuff that really doesn't belong to you. And so we see this all the time when, you know, you have a firm that has 8 employees, they tell you they're a $10 million agency and you're like, no, you're not. Actually, you're a $2 million agency that does $8 million of advertising spend per year, right? There's a very big difference. You don't want to spend money like a $10 million agency. That would be a really bad idea. but for most firms, it's not that extreme. So that's step one. Isolate pass-through expenses. That gets you to agency gross income. Now, the next step is we need to figure out what is it costing us to earn that agency gross income. And that's where we want to isolate what we call delivery expenses. And the problem with delivery expenses is most of it's going to be made up of payroll. And often there's some what we call shared delivery expenses in there. So if you run a design agency, you probably have a Figma subscription for your whole team, right? It's not something that you allocate to each individual project. That's just like a tool in your team's tool belt that they bring to work every day. If you run an ad agency, you probably have some advertising management tools or some tracking tools. So you want to basically measure how much of our payroll is going towards delivery and, you know, do we have any shared delivery expenses? Mm-hmm. And the problem we see on most P&Ls is all the payroll is going into one account on the P&L. Everybody in the company, regardless of what they do, it all goes into one big payroll account. So without going in and doing some kind of salary allocations, we can't actually see, okay, well, how much of this payroll is actually meant for doing client work? Therefore, we can't measure the delivery margin of the business. So often it's software and payroll are the two problematic accounts. And at the very least, what we want to do is separate that into two accounts, one for delivery payroll and for software, similarly, one for software specific to delivery, and then the rest of it can go in another big account for overhead, or it can be split out more granularly. But if we can do that, then we can start to get a sense of, okay, like what is the delivery margin of this business on a financial basis? And most people, when they go and do this math, even on the back of a napkin, they'll realize we're not hitting that 50% benchmark. We're quite a bit lower than that. Mm-hmm. Then the question becomes, okay, well, why is it that we're lower than we need to be? And what do we do about it? And that's where the utility of financial reporting is, you know, actually not going to be that high. Firstly, because it's fairly retroactive most of the time. You're looking at your P&L 2-3 weeks after the month is done, if you're lucky. And it's very, very expensive and cumbersome to try and get more detailed than that in the P&L. You want to do project-based accounting or department-based accounting. It adds a lot of cost and complexity and will often delay the reconciliation timeline. Mm-hmm. So instead, this is where we want to bridge the gap into operations and say, okay, well, what are the things that we can measure much more frequently and with much less expense that will help us predict the outcome on our financials ahead of time and that allow us to make much better decisions closer to the ground because we know that those are the things that lead to healthy delivery margin. So I'll pause there and get hydrated before we transition.
Yeah, no, absolutely. This is so fascinating and so practical. This is really like on the ground level practicality. Marcel, thank you for this.
That's the goal. So if you're listening to this and you've kind of paused the episode and you've done the math and you're like, okay, yeah, my delivery margin is not where it needs to be. I need to get it up. Yeah. How do you do that? And there's really kind of three operational levers that control delivery margin. So first, let's talk about the formula for delivery margin. It's a very simple margin formula. It's agency gross income, which again is your revenue minus any pass-through expenses. So agency gross income minus your delivery costs divided by agency gross income. So if my firm does $1 million in a year and I spend $400,000 on delivery costs, then I would have a 60% delivery margin. Yeah. So based on that formula, you can see there's two ways to improve this number. You can either decrease the costs and keep the revenue the same, or you can increase the amount of money that you're bringing in while keeping your costs the same. So if we think about operationally, how do we achieve that? We'll start with decreasing cost, which is my least favorite. So we'll start with that, the first one. The proxy for that operationally is what we call average cost per hour. And average cost per hour is this really easy way to figure out for any segment of the business. So the three metrics I'm about to discuss, the beautiful thing about these is you can use them to look at any time period, a day, a week, a month, a quarter, and you can use them to look at any cross-section of the business, a single client, a group of clients, a department, a type of product or service, right? So any way that you can slice and dice the two inputs that are required for each of these metrics, you can compare anything to anything and you can do it over any time horizon. That's part of the reason that I love these metrics so much. So average cost per hour allows you to ask for any time period or for any cross-section of the business, on average, what did an hour of labor cost us in that area? And you can start to compare. When we do website projects, our average cost per hour is X. When we do SEO projects, our average cost per hour is Y. And you can start to identify where is our average cost per hour high. And that is generally an indication that more expensive people need to do a larger share of the work on those kinds of deliverables. And that's not inherently a bad thing, but often what that poses is an opportunity to improve the process, create better documentation, use technology to leverage that process, and displace a lot of work from very senior people that could be done by more junior people. And in aggregate, what that should do is either change the composition of your team to be less top heavy. And if you use freelancers and contractors, it will very immediately lower your costs on every single project. So that operational proxy is a really useful one to say, okay, how do we get the same work done, but do it with less cost?
You know, reducing costs, cutting costs is something that is a lever that every business owner is aware of. I don't know that I've heard anybody talk about it like you just did.
Well, I think part of that is maybe it's a little bit unsavory to suggest that lowering the amount of judgment required to do something means that generally you can use less experienced labor, and less experienced labor tends to be less expensive. And for some reason that maybe sounds a little bit controversial, but it's generally, again, it's a general generalization, but it is generally true. Yeah. And so I'm, you know, just being blunt about it. And yeah, it is very objective. Like you can use these numbers and really start to identify very quickly, where are we having to leverage very experienced and expensive talent to get things done? And I'll give you an example in our own business. There was a deliverable that I used to do. It took me about 40 hours to do. And to displace myself, like since then, I've hired somebody to do that job that I was doing. We call it the consultant in our business. That job is about $150,000, $160,000 a year job. So it's fairly expensive. And it was taking 40 hours of that person to do this deliverable. And then we worked very hard on process and documentation and technology, et cetera. And we were able to get about 75% of that work now done by an account manager. And it's things like collecting information from the client, setting up the template for the presentation deck, tooling up all of the spreadsheets, doing some of the initial data analysis. So by doing that, the account manager costs about half of what a consultant does. We were able to lower that cost per hour by about 40%, which really helped improve our margins without having to change the price of that work. So that's just like a very practical example of how that applies to a given type of work.
I love the intentional evaluation you're using here. You know, this is not something that you're winging. I don't hear winging anywhere in what you're describing. I talk to leaders and I tell them all the time, experience does not make you any better. You can have 20 years of experience and it does not make you any better than day one. Evaluated experience makes you better. And you are so intentional with your evaluation of how you are doing this and so intentional. I wanted to comment on that because I think a lot of business owners are not. They're not evaluating that honestly and that ruthlessly.
And, this is the Catalytic Leadership Podcast. And so to tie this back to leadership, I've learned that that's really important because having subjective discussions with the team is a really dangerous game that often does not create a lot of winners.
Yes.
And what I've figured out is that, at least for myself, and I've observed this with a lot of our clients, when you can just create objectivity with data, that gives everybody a chance to get on the same side of the table and say, how do we work together to get this from where it is to where it needs to be, right? We can all agree on what the target is. We can all agree that if we get there and the business is thriving, everybody will benefit from that, and here's how. So let's all get on the same side of the table and figure out how to solve this problem. And when we don't have this data, what we find is you get into a project retrospective and the conversation quickly devolves into arguing about what we think happened as opposed to focusing on solving the problem itself. And so that's why I'm so, really passionate about trying to empower teams with this kind of data, because it completely changes the dynamic.
Yeah. Well, and it can also devolve in an unhealthy team dynamic to where you're blaming. Well, you Correct. Know, if Bob and his team, if they had done their job right, we wouldn't be in this mess. You know, I mean, I've seen that. And too often that kind of dysfunctionality on a team will manifest in a hot wash or retrospective like you're describing.
Yeah, the risk of that is certainly higher. Of course, having objective data about what happened doesn't completely mitigate that risk, but it certainly can reduce the chance of it happening. So there are some people listening that, like me, I've told them that there's three numbers. We've only given them one. If I don't close that loop, they're not going to be able to sleep tonight. So
that was my next question. You got to finish it. Yeah. I mean, I'm making a list here. So
absolutely. All right. So don't worry, guys. Let's back into it. So we talked about the first lever for affecting delivery margin, which is average cost per hour. That's related to decreasing costs. The next two I'm going to discuss are related to increasing the amount of revenue that your team can generate without changing the cost structure at all. Mm-hmm. And the first one is what we call average billable rate. And the second that I say the word billable rate, there's some people listening that think, well, I don't bill by the hour, so this isn't relevant to me. And you could not be more wrong about that. The thing that's beautiful about average billable rate is, again, it normalizes any project, any client work, whether it's a project or it's retained work and recurring work, and it normalizes all billing models, whether you bill by the hour, you bill a flat rate, you do value-based pricing, you do sprint-based pricing, you get paid in Trident layers, doesn't matter. And you can do it over any time period and over any cross-section of work. So this is such a beautiful thing. You can compare anything to anything in exactly the same way. And the math on this number is very simple. You take your agency gross income, which again is the money you collected minus pass-through, and you divide it by what we call delivery hours. So how many hours were required to earn that revenue? Notice I didn't call it a billable hour. For a lot of people, those are going to be the same, but a billable hour is potentially problematic because it has the connotation that it matters if the client was billed for that time or not. But when we're looking at average billable rate, it doesn't matter if the client was billed. It only matters if it was required to get it done. And that's how it normalizes all these billing models. So if you think about this, let's imagine, here's a really good example of a report. We say, hey, let's look at our projects for the last 3 months and let's measure the average billable rate on all of them. And immediately we might see, hey, we got paid $50,000 for this project, but it took us a ton of time and we earned $100 for every hour that we invested. Whereas this other project that was only $10,000, we invested 50 hours to get it done and it was really efficient. We earned $200 per hour. Mm-hmm. What kind of interesting conversation could you have around that? Hey, what can we learn from that 50-hour project that we earned $200 an hour on? Is there something that we're doing on those types of things that we can learn from and apply to others? What about this website? Is there something that we're missing in the scoping? Was there something about our process that felt clunky, that felt like it was getting in our way? And we can really get curious and invite the team to start contributing to that conversation. And this sounds too simple to be true, but if you think about it, if you sold every hour that your team had available for twice as much money, you would earn twice as much revenue without changing anything else. That's just math. That's not my opinion. That's just math.
That's it.
So that's the power of average billable rate, is it really gives you this simple, cost-effective lens that allows you to really start to spot the opportunities in the business to improve the level of efficiency with which your team creates value. Hmm.
This is something any leader, any business owner that is listening can do.
Yes. Very simple.
I just want to make sure, I want to say that because I know there's people listening here like, oh, this is so complicated. I can't do this. Listen to it again. Back it up. Let's do it again. You can absolutely do this.
Yeah. How much did you get paid? How much time went into it? And this is where I want to take a quick side tangent. Precision and accuracy are not the same thing. This is a trap I see a lot of people fall into. They go, well, we can't measure that precisely. Therefore, we're not going to do it at all. And it's like, well, if you had 80% of the time captured on a project and you knew that roughly 80% was in there, so you applied a heuristic to that time to say, okay, well, if we assume that this is 80%, roughly this is how much time we spent. Now you have a directionally accurate sense and you can start to compare things. Is that not better than nothing? And is that not going to be an accurate insight despite not being that precise? So decouple those two concepts. Precision and accuracy are not the same thing. And often in these kinds of things, precision comes at the cost of accuracy. They should not be confused as being the same.
Jim Collins taught us this, right? Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the great.
That's right. That's a great quote. I gotta use that one more myself. All right. So metric one was average cost per hour. That's about decreasing cost. Metric two is average billable rate. That's about increasing the amount of revenue and value that our team can earn. The third one, which for the Star Wars nerds in the room, is the dark saber of agency metrics. It has great power, but it can do great harm in the wrong hands, is a metric we've all probably heard of. It's called utilization. And so utilization is really answering the question of all the time that I'm purchasing from my team in bulk, how much of it am I able to resell to clients in order to earn that average billable rate that I talked about earlier. The measurement for this, there's a project manager that's going to have an aneurysm when I tell them how we measure this, because it's not precise, but it is more accurate. And it's also very simple. You take delivery hours worked, and again, across any area of the business, any time period, any cross-section of the team, whether it's a single person, a group of people, the whole business, doesn't matter. What was the amount of delivery time worked? And what was the total capacity for the group of people selected in that time period? We're not subtracting out of capacity things like time off, sick time, holidays, vacations, internal non-billable time. We leave all of that in there. Now, why is that? Well, think about it for a second. If we start to remove all of that from capacity, then the more time off and non-billable time that the team has, the higher our utilization rate goes. That would indicate to us that we get more profitable the less we work. And again, that might feel more convenient and it might make the team feel better and it might make it feel like this measurement is more fair because, well, we don't actually have all of that capacity available, but it's a false It's a false positive. It's the opposite of the truth. And so we can't really measure it that way. We need to see the cost of those things reflected. And the way that we do that is by including all of that stuff in the total capacity. So we can get a real look at, you know, what percentage of our time really is earning that average billable rate. And so it also happens to be much simpler to measure because I don't have to chase down how much time off somebody has accrued, you know, what holidays are coming up this month every time that I want to measure this metric. So the benchmark for this is, as an entire agency for the entire year, 50 to 60%. I know that that sounds low, and it is because, again, you have to consider that everyone's not working all the time. Everyone gets vacation, everybody gets holidays, sick time, et cetera. And if people are telling you that they're getting 85, 90% utilization rates, it's because they're not measuring it the same way. That's the only reason why. Nobody is getting those kinds of utilization rates under this calculation. If they are, they're violating labor laws, and that's not necessarily something we want to be modeling.
No, let's discourage that clearly and vocally right now.
Yes. And so I want to tie these things together because we talk about these metrics and it's a little bit obscure still. I want to draw out an example. So let's imagine we have a team of five people. They have roughly 10,000 hours of capacity in a year. That's 2,000 hours per person multiplied by five people. Mm-hmm. If they were utilized at 50%, that would mean 5,000 of those hours are going to be used to earn value. And on average, they earn $100 for each hour. So they earn $500,000 in agency gross income in that time period. In example two, we increase that utilization rate to 60%. So it's 6,000 hours multiplied by $100. They've now made $600,000 with that same team. Imagine the costs haven't changed. We just added $100,000 to the bottom line. Pretty cool. In the third example, we keep that 60% utilization rate, and then we increase the average billable rate through some process improvements, through a couple pricing tweaks to 125. That same team has now earned $750,000. So we've just added $250,000 or increased their revenue production by 50%. Without changing any of the costs, all of that flows to the bottom line if we choose to let it, or we can choose to reinvest into the business. Doesn't matter. That's the power of these seemingly small tweaks to operations on the actual financial performance of the business. And again, these are three simple numbers that anyone can measure, that you can use to look at any cross-section of the business, and that don't require any financial data. You can just do this with the data that your team creates every day in a project management tool and with estimates and quotes from clients.
Marcel, that is so helpful. I really, just as a business owner myself, that is so helpful. And I know our listeners feel the same. I want to dive in for just a minute into you, right? You are not the same leader you were 5 years ago.
Definitely not.
You can't be, because your business requires more of you now. 5 years from now, your business is going to require even more. It's going to require you to lead at a higher level. How do you stay on top of your game? How do you level up with the skills that you need to be developing to be the leader your team and your business need you to be?
It's a great question. And of course, it's a very big question. And you're absolutely right in that, you know, a mentor of mine, Dan, actually, says this all the time, where he says, if your business is stalled and it's not growing, look in the mirror, because that's the bottleneck. Yep. And that has been so true. You know, when I look back on the moments where we had these breakthroughs or where we got stuck, it always kind of came back to my capacity to lead the business into the next stage that it needed to be, or to grow to become the person that could, you know, handle being the leader of a business where the stakes were higher, the team was bigger, et cetera. And if I think about the three things that have really helped me become a better leader, the first one is personal development. And, you know, I think this is true about most people. I haven't had a perfect life. I have baggage and trauma that I bring into the office every day, and I'm not aware of how it shows up a lot of the time. And so there is a constant amount of work that has to go into reflecting on that, and identifying those things and identifying how they show up and learning how to control those things, how to redirect those things, how to heal those things. So my baggage isn't coming at the cost of my ability to lead. And so that's the first one. And that's, you know, it's journaling, it's therapy, it's all of those things. The second is education and coaching, right? So, you know, I've been listening to like all the Pat Lencioni books recently. I love those, the Fables especially. They're so easy to listen to.
Such a fan of Lencioni.
And those kinds of books are what I found is you listen to them at different stages of your life and you learn different things every time.
Yeah.
Because you can wrap your context into those stories. And so even if you just have a couple of great books that you come back to, you know, throughout different points in your career, that constant, you know, looking at a problem through that different set of eyes is really helpful. And coaching combined with that is also so critical, because sometimes you just got to get it out of your head in front of somebody like yourself that can look at it objectively. Because, you know, being a leader is an emotional thing. You have relationships with your people, you're in the trenches with them every day. And it's very, very hard to, even if you have very high emotional intelligence, completely parse those things apart and to look at the issues that you're having from another set of eyes. And so having somebody that can challenge you, that can call you on your shit, that can help you see a different perspective, that can ask you sometimes the insanely simple questions that you're not asking yourself, yeah, can be a massive lever in helping, you know, address how you show up in the business and get to that next level. Mm-hmm. And so that's number two. And number three, I've got to say, is really just like practice and leaning in.
Yeah.
You know, like we're going to make mistakes. And the biggest point there that has been helpful for me is actually getting feedback from the team. And that has to be intentional, because the team's not going to give you feedback when you're their boss. Yeah. No matter how much you try to, and I try very hard to be incredibly receptive to feedback, to thank my team, to celebrate them in front of the rest of the team for daring to give me critical feedback when they do it. And even when I do all of those things, they're still very apprehensive. Something has to be very, very wrong for them to unprompted pull me aside and say, can I give you some feedback on something? So as an organization, we have to facilitate specific exercises on a quarterly basis to really try to draw that stuff out of our teams. And it's always, always, always insightful. So it's, you know, not being afraid to lean in and continue to push yourself as a leader, but installing those feedback loops very, very intentionally. Because if you're waiting for your team to tell you that something's wrong, it's going to be too late by the time they come around and tell you that. In my experience, that's been my hallucination.
100%, man. I agree with everything you just said there. You know, if you could go back and talk to yourself before you started your business with what you know now, what would you love to go back and tell yourself?
Oh, smarten up, man. No, in all seriousness, the biggest mistakes that I've made have been, and this sounds really nuanced and it is, but I spent way too much time trying to prove myself right instead of proving myself wrong. And that subtle change of execution is so critical, because, you know, I got into business probably for all the wrong reasons. You know, I had a chip on my shoulder. I had something to prove. I thought I was better than everyone else. But really, I was deeply insecure. And that's how all those things were manifesting themselves. And so I needed to be right. I needed to have an idea that was good. I needed to get out there and sell it. I needed to grow the business. I needed to accomplish things to validate this story that I want to be able to tell about myself. And that underlying fear of not being good enough, of not being successful, et cetera, actually held me back from challenging myself and asking myself the hard questions that would have saved me a lot of time and a lot of headaches, because I would have gotten to product market fit quicker. I would have addressed issues in the products that I was selling quicker. I would have really identified the things that were holding me back from growth quicker. But because I was afraid of asking myself those questions, I didn't do it. And so again, I was trying to prove myself right instead of stepping back and saying, how can I prove myself wrong as quickly as possible? And by doing that, really getting to the things that needed to be addressed in order to unlock more growth. And that has been the shift, you know, as I think I've worked on those aspects and I've had enough success to appease some of that sentiment.
Yeah.
I'm much more willing now to come in and say, like, nothing is safe in this business. We need to constantly be challenging our assumptions about what we think is correct and really coming from a place of saying, how do we deliver more value and solve more problems for our customers? Mm.
So much insight there, Marcel. You know, a mentor of mine says, what would you rather? Would you rather be right, or would you rather make a difference? You get to pick one. And I just hear so much of that same insight and wisdom in what you just shared. Thank you for that.
That's a great quote.
Is there a book that has made a tremendous difference in your journey that you would recommend that the listeners pick up and add to their to-read list?
There have been a lot. I'm a big fan of fables. I'm writing a book right now. Actually, I'm trying to write it as a fable. It's significantly harder, but I'm hoping that it will be worth it. And it's on all of these things, by the way. I want to write the fable of the agency that struggles with all of these numbers and eventually figures it out.
Love
And so I'm going to recommend two, actually. My top two are, number one, The Go-Giver, which I think is one of the great, simple, easy to read, you know, business fables, but really talks about some fundamentals that the older I get, the more timeless I realize that they are.
Yeah.
And the second is The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, you know, which I think if there was just one business book that you could read, that would probably be the one that I'd recommend.
You know, often people will leave an episode like this with one big idea. You know, we've covered a lot of ground today. But they'll leave with one big idea. If you could define that one big idea, what would you want that to be?
Know what it costs you to earn your money. That's it. Just know that. Because if you don't, everything's going to be a lot harder.
I love that. Simple, wise, and profound. Marcel, this has been a masterclass today in this topic. I'm so grateful for your generosity, your open-handedness with what you've learned so far. I know people are going to want to stay connected with you and continue to learn from you. What is the best way for them to do that?
You can check us out at parakeeto.com. And if you want to grab a free toolkit that's full of training videos and templates and cheat sheets to help you actually measure all the numbers that I talked about today, you can grab that absolutely free at parakeeto.com/toolkit. And if you want to connect with me, the best place to find me is on LinkedIn. And if you like podcasts, check out the Agency Profit podcast, where we talk about these kinds of things all the time.
And I'll recommend that one as well. One of my new favorites.
Thanks for joining me for this episode today. As we wrap up, I'd love for you to do two things. First, subscribe to this podcast so you don't miss an episode. And if you find value here, I'd love it if you would rate it and review it. That really does make a difference in helping other people to discover this podcast. Second, if you don't have a copy of my newest book, Catalytic Leadership, I'd love to put a copy in your hands. If you go to catalyticleadershipbook.com, you can get a copy for free. Just pay the shipping so I can get it to you and we'll get one right out. My goal is to put this into the hands of as many leaders as possible. This book captures principles that I've learned in 20 plus years of coaching leaders in the entrepreneurial space, in business, government, nonprofits, education, and the local church. You can also connect with me on LinkedIn to keep up with what I'm currently learning and thinking about. And if you're ready to take a next step with a coach to help you intentionally grow and thrive as a leader, I'd be honored to help you. Just go to catalyticleadership.net to book a call with me. Stay tuned for our next episode next week. Until then, as always, leaders, choose to be catalytic.
Thanks for listening to Catalytic Leadership with Dr. William Attaway. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss the next episode. Want more? Go to catalyticleadership.net.